Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the past four decades, the packaged and processed food industries have been manipulating our taste buds by adding the perfect amounts of salt, sugar, and fat to their products. The decision to mix these three ingredients has been wildly successful. Over the past 30 years, our annual consumption of sugar-sweetened sodas has more than doubled to 40 gallons. Every year, Americans consume about twice the recommended amount of salt and fat, and 70 pounds of sugar. That's 22 teaspoons of sugar every day. Every year, Americans eat 33 pounds of cheese, triple what they ate in 1970. That is a lot of saturated fat. The processed food industry accounts for $1 trillion a year in sales. That's $1 trillion. And the total economic cost of the health crisis we're facing is approaching $300 billion a year. One in three adults and one in five children is clinically obese, and 26 million Americans have diabetes. This was not the case four decades ago. So how did this happen? In his meticulously researched book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us, New York Times investigative journalist Michael Moss shows how the major players in the processed food industry have succeeded in getting hundreds of millions of people hooked on salty chips, cheese, sugary sodas, cereals, and other packaged foods, if you can call them food in some cases, through sophisticated food science, marketing, and lobbying. In his book, he writes, "This book will, quote, show how the makers of processed foods have chosen time and again to double down on their efforts to dominate the American diet, gambling that consumers won't figure them out. It will show how they push ahead despite their own misgivings, and it will hold them accountable for the social costs that keep climbing, even as some of their own say, enough already." Michael Moss is a Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times investigative journalist and the author of the new book, Salt, Sugar, Fat. And he joins us from Argo Studios in New York. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. How's my hometown today?
It's gorgeous. Your hometown is doing very well. So, you know, Michael, your book is fascinating. As someone who, you know, does a lot of reading about food, and of course, as you know, this is the home of the local food movement and the slow food movement. First off, I just wanted to ask you, what did you have for breakfast this morning?
I had a big pot of French press coffee, and that was it.
That was it. Well,
that was it. You know, I was just going to say, I mean, often in my house, my wife Eve works outside of the home, too. And for us, the mornings are often a, you know, 7 a.m. nightmare where we're sort of focusing entirely on getting the two boys some good breakfast and out the door with everything. So the last thing I remember was scrambling and trying to find, like, the key to the bike lock for my 9-year-old's bike so he could bike to school instead of taking the bus.
What did you make your kids for breakfast?
So we're really working on this, and it's sort of part of our strategy here, and I sort of learned this from researching and reporting the book, is to sort of take control of processed foods rather than let them control us. And one thing we've discovered is you can give them whole wheat pancakes, and they really don't object. I mean, my own boys draw the line at whole wheat pasta. So typically in the morning, they'll get a whole wheat pancake with some frozen blueberries mixed in two or three times a week. Other times they'll get a whole wheat toast. We also find that we can give them whole wheat toast without their objecting to it. So they'll get whole wheat toast and then with cold cereal. And we've sort of been working with them to try to find cereals in the store that have less sugar than most brands.
So the thing I also love about this book is that it's meticulously researched. You filed Freedom of Information Act requests for government records. You pored over previously unseen internal documents, including a trove of 81 million pages. You went to a number of places, a science factory, which we'll talk about. And then you also spoke with a number of executives who are now kind of speaking out against this industry. So I just wanted to put that out there because it's so meticulously researched.
Thank you.
Talk a little bit about what started this reporting. What happened in early 2009 in Southwest Georgia?
So I was actually reporting on Islamic militancy, of all things, when my editors decided to find something safer for me. And in Georgia, in the corner of Georgia near Alabama, there was an outbreak of salmonella in peanuts being processed. My editor at the New York Times, who's really smart. Her name is Christine Kay, about finding stories that are big and important to look at where we can do some digging. You know, if I didn't get it at the time, she did. Eight people died, an estimated 19,000 were sickened around the country. And as food companies scrambled around the country to recall hundreds of products that had been using these peanuts, it became evident to us that, look, here are peanuts supposedly making you healthy and things you would give your kids who are, in fact, killing people. You know, B, these are being made right here in the United States, not in China or some far off place. And the third ingredient to making it a really interesting big story was that they're being used by a $1 trillion processed food industry about which we know really very little. And as I dug into it, the overriding theme was evident, which is the industry had lost control of its ingredients. It was buying ingredients from dozens and dozens and dozens of vendors around the world and not taking some obvious steps that it could to increase the scrutiny of those vendors and protect our safety. And I then segued to look at outbreaks of E. coli in hamburger and was lucky to come across a trove of internal meat industry documents that let me for the first time write about an anatomy of one hamburger that had made a lot of people sick. And again, the issue was sort of lack of control, meat industry not taking certain steps that it could do to protect our safety. And I was in the course of reporting on that when I had dinner with one of my best sources in Seattle. He said to me, Michael, look, as tragic as these outbreaks are, there's another public health crisis afoot involving things that we are intentionally putting into our food, we being the processed food industry of which he was a part, intentionally putting in their food over which we have absolute control. He was talking about salt, and then that led to me to look at sugar and fat. This is the holy trinity, these three ingredients for the processed food industry on which they survive.
And going back to the story about E. coli and the hamburger, you write about 22-year-old former dance teacher Stephanie Smith, who was paralyzed. She's in Minnesota. And you said you got your hands on this trove of documents, which showed why the government is protective of this industry. It's supposed to be holding accountable. And when I read this part of your book, the burger that Stephanie ate, made by Cargill, had been in various grades of meat from different parts of the cow and from multiple slaughterhouses as far away as Uruguay. How common is this?
That's actually very common. I had the misconception that a hamburger was drawn from one part of the cow and then ground up, and that made the patty that you bought. But in fact, it's an amalgam of scraps of meat that are mixed in, that come from slaughterhouses around the world, that are mixed and matched by what the meat industry calls the least cost formulation, depending on how much fat is in each ingredient. And I was able to sort of, you know, go back from the processor. In this case, it was the Cargill company that made the patty that her mom cooked for their Sunday dinner that paralyzed Stephanie from the waist down because of the E. coli contamination, and traced it back to the slaughterhouses that they used. And, you know, to look at what steps were being taken and were not being taken to ensure the safety of that meat.
And so, as you said, the industry methodically studies and controls their use. And so salt, sugar, and fat is no accident. It's put in these foods purposely. And before we talk about the meeting that took place in 1999, what did you learn about the science behind, let's say, salt, for example? Because so much testing has been done on salt.
I also had the misconception that salt was something that was dug out of the ground as a rock and it got, you know, ground up and that's what you would apply to food. But it turns out there are more than 40 different, salt is rather manufactured into 40 different shapes, sizes, permutations, if you include all the ingredients, each of them sort of perfectly engineered to match the processed food product and also to maximize what the industry calls the flavor burst. That is the allure of salt, which often on snack foods, salt is often the first thing that hits the taste buds. The saliva interacts with it, sends signals to the pleasure center of your brain, which says, hey, Michael, love that, keep eating. Salt is engineered into very fine powders for quick dissolving into canned soups to my favorite, sort of a kosher type salt that's in the shape of a pyramid, flat side so it sticks better to food, hollowed out on the inside so it's maximum contact with the saliva, precisely engineered again to provide one of the three basic tenets of maximum allure to foods.
And then what does the science say about the relationship between salt, sugar, and fat?
Well, one of the fascinating things I learned, too, is that often by mixing those three together, you can enhance any one of their three properties. There's a synergy that goes on. Fat is an especially sort of really fascinating element. You know, it's not one of the five basic tastes that Aristotle wrote about, first identified way back when. It's a sensation. It's that feeling you get when you bite into a toasted cheese sandwich, that warm, gooey feel. And there's almost sort of no limit for our liking of fat. If there is, it's way up in the land of heavy cream someplace. But companies have discovered if you add a little bit of sweetness to fat, the appeal of fat and the brain's inability to sort of detect all of the calories in fat will fall by the wayside. And so adding just a little bit of sugar will even increase our liking for fat even more than it is.
What's interesting is I just assumed that sugar was the magical of the three pillars. But you report that manufacturers actually say salt is at the top of their list.
Well, yes. And the really amazing thing about salt, when I get to that section of the book and I sort of held it for last, is that when you start talking about salt to these processed food companies, the largest in the world, it's almost they begin adopting kind of the language of the addicted. They are more hooked on salt than you and I are, and I'm a real salt person, so that's actually saying a lot. It turns out that we're actually not born liking salt as we are sugar and fat. Our liking for salt doesn't develop until we're about 6 months of age, and recent research has shown that our liking and cravings for salt are hugely influenced by the processed food industry. Kids exposed to processed foods starting at 6 months will be much more apt to be licking the salt shaker by the time they're in preschool. But that said, the industry itself is even more hooked on salt because it's a miracle ingredient for them. Not only does it provide that flavor, what they call the flavor burst, but look, salt is really inexpensive, 10 cents a pound. It can help them avoid using more costly ingredients like fresh herbs and spices. It acts as a preservative, which is essential to their notion of providing foods that will stay on the shelf for weeks or months at a time. And it also masks some of the off notes that inherently creep into the production of processed foods. We can talk a little bit about my experience at Battle Creek, Michigan, where Kellogg invited me in to impress upon me how difficult it was for them to dial back on the amounts of salt given what they're being asked to do by consumers and public officials.
So what did you try and how did it taste?
So they made for me specially prepared versions of some of their biggest icons without any salt in them at all. And we started with the cracker Cheez-Its, which normally I could eat all day long. Cheez-Its without salt, we couldn't even swallow them. They stuck to the roof of our mouth.
Wow.
Because salt provides solubility and texture. We moved on to the frozen waffles, popped them in the toaster. They came out looking and tasting like straw. And the clincher was when we tried the cereal in a bowl, a little bit of milk. And before I could say anything after eating, the company's chief spokesman sitting across from me got this look of horror on her face. And she swallowed and said, you know, metal, M-E-T-A-L. I taste metal in this. And the chief scientist who was also with us sort of got a little smirk on his face and said, yeah, look, not everybody tastes that metallic taste, but many, many people do. And it's a result of adding this or adding that, sometimes vitamins, sometimes minerals. But whatever the cause, we find that the salt will mask or obviate the taste of that awful taste in the food.
It's amazing to think that this industry uses 5 billion pounds of salt a year. And when we talk about this industry, can you name some of the big players?
Oh, sure. The companies I look at are all the biggest. Kellogg, General Mills, Kraft, Nestle, Campbell's Soup, on and on. Because I really, you know, in researching and writing this book, and for me it was so much like being inside a detective story, you know, I needed to know what the largest companies were doing and how they were approaching and increasing. And I was so surprised to learn that they have been privately wrestling with this whole issue of their culpability on the obesity crisis for years and years and years.
Yeah.
And also, look, I mean, we've also known for years, look, we've always known that these, you know, eating too much of these foods, and I like to say it's the foods we hate to love, can make you overweight or obese. But now we know that the industry has known this for, you know, many more years beyond even a decade.
And we'll talk about that in just a couple of minutes. We're speaking today with Michael Moss, author of the new book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Really incredible data in this book talking about how much sugar, salt, and fat the average American eats a year. 70 pounds of sugar, 22 teaspoons of sugar every single day. What are your thoughts on this? How did we get here? And for a trillion-dollar industry, it's kind of incredible that this doesn't get more attention. So how have you been personally affected by salt, sugar, and fat? And what questions do you have for Michael? And we should also note that when he talks about some of the data, he's being very specific about this data, and it comes from a place called Monell Chemical Census Center. So there are all of these scientists that are studying all of this information. They bring children in, for example, and give them 10 different kinds of yogurt to find out what makes them smile really big. So what questions do you have for Michael Moss about the research and the information he uncovered in looking at this massive industry? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. So, Michael, let's talk a little bit about the meeting that took place back on April 8th, 1999. 11 CEOs of the largest food companies, all men. At the time, they controlled 700,000 employees and $280 billion in annual sales.
They were brought together for a very rare and private meeting at the old Pillsbury headquarters in Minneapolis. And it was rare because normally these heads of these companies are at each other's throats. The competition in the grocery store for space on the shelf is incredibly fierce. But they were brought together to sit down and talk about none other than their culpability in the emerging obesity crisis, emerging because this was back in 1999 where the numbers were less than they are now. And standing before them on the stage, and this is the other extraordinary thing about this meeting, was none other than a senior official of Kraft, then the largest food manufacturer in the United States, a man named Michael Mudd. And he was armed with 114 slides that he used to essentially lay responsibility for the obesity crisis at their feet. And not just obesity, but diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease. He even began linking their foods with several types of cancers. And he said to them, look, if you don't accept responsibility, the lawyers, let me tell you, it's not a matter of if, but when the lawyers who went after big tobacco will come after big food with a litigation against you. And Michael Mudd began pleading with them to collectively do the right thing on behalf of consumers. And again, the key word here is collectively, because he knew that they were so fiercely competitive that no individual company could set out and do the right thing without getting pushed back and pulled back into the fold by competition from other companies.
I was surprised to read that he connected these foods to several types of cancer, and I think you were too.
I was, because, you know, unfortunately for consumers, nutrition science tends to be really mushy. I mean, we're not spending the kind of money that we do looking at pharmaceuticals to do double-blind, randomized trials. And so much about what we know about food and nutrition and health still is a matter of guesswork. And I personally wouldn't be linking processed foods to the several types of cancers that he did, again, given the so very little we know about some aspects of food.
Right, because you write that you're actually uncomfortable making that connection.
And fortunately, I didn't have to, because what was staggering in looking at the trove of insider documents that I came across is that the companies, you know, within these largest food giants, there have been and are cabals of insiders who accept responsibility for the health impact of their foods and have been working inside to get their companies to deal with, respond to that, dial back on their formulations in whatever possible way, address their marketing. And so I didn't have to make the case that processed foods, eating too much of them, were making people unhealthy. You know, the companies themselves, insiders, were acknowledging that, at least when they talked privately with each other.
And how did the other CEOs respond to this? I guess you can call it a call to action.
You know, from Michael Mudd, the executive from Kraft's perspective, the meeting was an utter failure. The CEOs reacted defensively. They said, you know, look, we already provide consumers with a choice. If they want low-fat this or low-sugar that, we're making those versions of our mainline products, and they're there on the shelf to be found. We have a responsibility to both consumers and to shareholders, mind you. And look, bottom line is we can't put a product out there that's not absolutely, utterly tasty, or no one will buy it.
We're speaking with Michael Moss, author of Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. And let's hear from Arturo in San Francisco, who called 866-798-8255. Hi, Arturo. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. I have a question just relating to the larger question of processed foods. I'm a survivor of the vast array of baked chips, rice chips, quinoa chips, and whatnot at local Rainbow, and managed to resist it most of the time. So I'm well aware of what you're talking about. But my question relates to the use of flavorings, comb, or with the idea of also being a preservative, like, for example, acetic acid or vinegar in these products, to which I happen to be acutely sensitive and allergic, and also citric acid, phosphoric acid, and whether you have any observations on this masking of actual preservatives as flavorings.
This is a great question because, Michael, I'm sure as you know, even when you buy organic cereals or granola bars, for example, 9 times out of 10, they include xanthan gum, ascorbic acid, natural flavoring, what is that? So what about those additives?
Well, there's kind of two things there. One, you know, putting the word organic on the front of a package is a huge selling device these days. And it means basically that product should have far less pesticides than a non-organic product might have. But beyond that, you know, those products can be loaded with salt, sugar, fat, and any of the 5,000 additives out there that the processed food industry uses, which the federal government considers to be safe, but are largely untested by the government and do raise some concern. It's something that I'm just now looking at in terms of my, you know, through my reporting at the New York Times. So I don't have an answer for you in regards to those particular additives. And by and large, I have to believe that those additives, especially because we're eating so minuscule amounts of them, you know, are probably by and large safe. But there's no question that people have concerns about individual ones of those.
Well, thank you for calling in, Arturo. And you can join us if you have questions for Michael Moss about his new book, Salt, Sugar, and Fat: How Do Corporations Manipulate Nutrition to Fatten Their Bottom Lines? It's your call. We'll be back after this.
This is Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco, online, kalw.org. We're in the last few days of our spring membership campaign, and here during your call today, we have a challenge. If we can get 20 KALW listeners to either call 800-525-9917 or go online and click at kalw.org, there's an extra $1,065 in it for Local Public Radio. Joining me here in studio, General Manager Matt Martin. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning. Bodies, your support at 800-525-9917 for a $120 contribution to KALW. We will send you salt, sugar, fat. for a $120 contribution to local public radio. This is the number one New York Times bestseller, Pulitzer Prize winning author. He's done some amazing work. He was great on Fresh Air. I also heard him on the BBC the other day. If you appreciate this kind of voice, hey, you'll appreciate having this book as your thanks for local public radio.
800-525-9917, online at kalw.org. Click or call whatever it takes to get to 20 KALW listeners joining us today. There's an extra $1,065 in it for us. 800-525-9917 or online at KALW.org as we continue with our interruption-free membership campaign.
Yeah, this every break, every hour counts. So if you're a Your Call listener and you've been thinking, you know what, I want to support the work of Rose Aguilar and her team, this is a great time. We have Michael Moss's book, but at any level of contribution, you will be making a difference for local public radio, where your call is supported 100% by KALW.
And again, as Matt described, we have a great thank you gift available for you today for a $120 pledge. Salt, Sugar, and Fat, the book is yours. And you'll also have that great feeling inside of supporting local public radio. 800-525-9917 or online at KALW.org. Rose?
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll speak with Elizabeth Klein about her new book, Overdressed, The Shocking High Cost of Cheap Fashion. We will talk about the tragedy in Bangladesh. So many things have changed since that building collapsed. So we'll talk about which corporations are going to take action and which are not. On Wednesday, Jaron Lanier will join us to talk about his book, Who Owns the Future? And I just found out that for Friday's Media Roundtable, we just booked a tax reporter David K. Johnston to talk about media coverage of the IRS going after Tea Party organizations. So we will be joined by David K. Johnston on Friday. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're speaking with Michael Moss, author of Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. He writes about this $1 trillion industry. So many interesting and somewhat disturbing facts. The average American eats 35 pounds of cheese. We'll find out why cheese is in so many processed foods. 70 pounds of sugar, that's 22 teaspoons a day. So what questions do you have for Michael about his reporting and what he found? He talked to a number of insiders who say that they've got a lot of misgivings about what has happened over the past couple of decades. And what's your relationship with sugar, fat, and salt, sugar, and fat? And how does it affect the foods you eat and the choices you make? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. And Arturo, I just also wanted to let you know that we had a former FDA commissioner, David Kessler, on the show. I think it was a year and a half ago, author of The End of Overeating. And he said, and Michael, you'd be interested in this, that a lot of those additives like ascorbic acid and xanthan gum are now coming from China because they've been able to undercut American companies, which means we definitely don't know what's in them because obviously there's the USDA doesn't have a right to go to China to say what's in that ascorbic acid.
You know, I think there actually are some controls on imported additives to food. I mean, I've heard that the organic growing market in China actually can be really well regulated. But again, it falls down on this, increasingly global food chain of additives that go into our foods, over which the processed food industry sort of increasingly has less and less control over, with some exception.
So before we go back to callers, how has your opinion of this industry changed since doing this research? Because as you write, the manufacturers of these products say that, you know, people choose what they want to eat. They're busy. They need fast food. They like it. They don't have to buy it. How has your opinion on that claim changed?
Well, there's no question that there is some personal responsibility here. Experts I talk to like to say that there was a moment in the early 80s, almost overnight, when it became socially acceptable to eat anything, anywhere, anytime. And that's when you started seeing people eating and drinking, walking down the street or bringing food to business meetings. And that played right into the hands of especially the snack food industry and the development of products that people have come to see as sort of mindless eating, hand to mouth, without engaging the brain, sort of natural, you know, breaks on getting you to keep from overeating. So there's no question that is an element. But I was really astounded just to learn the depth of the commitment of these largest companies, not just to get you to like their products, but to get you to want more and more of them. That's an overriding theme in both the documents that I was able to get and also the interviews with the top scientists and marketing and CEO officials of these companies.
And you also write about the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia. Can you talk a little bit about that? This is an interesting one that most people have probably never heard of. Taxpayers, we fund about half of the center's $17.5 million budget, and then the rest comes from the food industry. It's kind of an odd arrangement.
It is, and I was, you know, being a reporter and investigative, especially I was suspicious of Monell at first, and I couldn't quite come to grips with their getting funding from the food industry and government at the same time. But the more time I spent there, the more impressed I was with their researchers. This place is like a clubhouse for PhDs. They have sort of, you know, trained and given rise to any number of food scientists that then go out and work for universities and private companies. And they are looking at sort of the pure science behind our liking for sugar, salt, and fat. These are the people who taught me that we are hardwired for sugar, especially every one of our 10,000 taste buds is just crazy, you know, sitting there waiting to get a sweet taste and send those signals to the brain. But at the same time, their scientists, many of them sound almost like consumer advocates, and they are so willing to hold the food industry accountable for its culpability in helping to shape our liking. So take sugar, for example. One of their top scientists said to me, look, you know, you can't get around the fact that these companies are exploiting the biology of the child, especially when they have made so many foods around the grocery store taste sweet. Sugar used to be just in the in the dessert, in the cookie aisle, and now breads are formulated to have an optimum sweetness. Low-fat yogurt can have as much sugar in it as ice cream these days. Even pasta sauces, you know, leading brands can have the equivalent of a couple of Oreo cookies in a tiny half-cup serving of pasta sauce. And what this does is teaches kids to expect sweetness in everything they eat to the exclusion of the other five basic tastes, including, you know, sour and bitter, which happens to be some of the flavors that you'll find in fresh fruits and vegetables.
Well, we have a caller on children and how this is marketed to children. So let's hear from Alan in San Francisco. Hi, Alan.
Hi. Yeah. So our relationship, my family's relationship with salt, sugar, and fat is really, we watch everything. We try to cook with whole foods as it's very difficult to do that. But our daughter, I'm having battles daily with her wanting to satisfy her taste buds with sugar. And we've tried xylitol. We tried some soy-based desserts. But she won't have it half the time. And it comes down to not a yelling match, but it's difficult. She's 7 years old.
Wow.
And she's addicted to sugar.
Wow. You know what? I can recommend dates with banana and almond butter. I guarantee she'll love that. But I know it's not a cure. Michael, what are your thoughts on that?
You know, again, in my family, we're not about avoiding processed foods at this point in our life. In fact, Michael Pollan, who has a great book out called Cook Now, came over to my house the other day. We went shopping at my local grocery store to find processed foods that we could cook and eat sort of in a minimum amount of time and with health. And we found some great stuff on the shelf of the grocery store. With our kids and sugar, though, we did an interesting experiment recently. My wife, Eve, said to them, look, guys, why don't we try to limit ourselves to those cereals with 5 grams of less per sugar? Again, look, maybe not as optimum of cooking with plain oatmeal. But we found two things. One, when they went shopping with us now, it became a bit of a hunt for them, and they would pull the boxes down, look at the fine print, and find those brands that had 5 grams or less, and they were plain Cheerios, Special K. I think they brought home Total, too. But the other thing I found, too, is that sort of by engaging them in a conversation about sugar, helping them to understand why they crave it so much, I actually found that they liked those cereals at least a bit better than they would otherwise. I mean, granted, on their own, they would probably buy the Fruit Loops or something totally high in sugar. But I actually find by talking to them, and that's one of the things I write about in the book, is the demise of the home economic system in this country, wherein girls and boys in many cases were taught how to shop, how to cook, how to be mindful about food and nutrition. Mm. That fell by the wayside in the 70s as the processed food companies began hiring their own home economists to help sell their products.
Well, that's a fascinating story. Can you just give us the brief overview of what happened to home ec in school? And what role these companies played?
Yeah, home ec was widespread in this country. There were tens of thousands of teachers in schools and in the ag economic service going out and teaching parents, again, how to shop, how to cook from scratch, how to be mindful about nutrition. The largest food companies began hiring these home economists, bringing them into their companies, where their job became selling the processed foods in stores as being convenient. And again, this was about the time when more and more, you know, people, both couples in the family were working outside of the home, putting pressure on them to get good food on the table. We were becoming more, you know, drawn toward convenience foods, and these companies began using home economists to sell that food and that notion of convenience to us.
Well, I have one more suggestion for you, Alan. Quinoa or steel-cut oats is really good with apples, blueberries, whatever kind of fruit you want to put in it. Put some cinnamon on top and then coconut syrup, which actually has low sugar, and I guarantee your kids will like it. So thank you so much for calling in, Alan. And before we move off of children, I just wanted to read a quote in your book from Julie Minella. She's a biopsychologist at Monell, and she says, quote, "What basic research and taste in children is shedding light on, and why the foods that they're making for children are so high in sugar and salt, is that they're manipulating or exploiting the biology of the child." She goes on to say, "I think that anyone who makes a product for a child has to take responsibility, because what they're doing is teaching the child the level of sweetness or saltiness the food should be. They're not just providing a source of calories, they're impacting the health of that child." So that word responsible, how do you deal with that one?
You know, I really struggle with that as a journalist. I don't happen to view the processed food industry as this inherently evil empire that intentionally set out to make us obese or otherwise ill. Michael Mudd, the gentleman at Kraft I told you about, who tried to get the industry collectively to do the right thing way back in 1999, I write about him in the book, and he recently wrote an op-ed for the New York Times in which he called on his former industry to adopt sort of a new ethical stance toward their culpability in the obesity crisis, etc. I'm not sure counting on these companies to do the ethical thing is the right way to go. I certainly know that people may be waiting a long time for companies to adopt a new ethics and responsibility. These are companies doing what companies do, which is to make as much money as possible, selling as much product as possible. And I think moving forward, that doesn't mean that they're not going to respond. And I happen to think we're at a real tipping point here. That doesn't mean they're not going to respond to consumer demands and people getting loud about caring about what they're putting into their bodies. But I think that response is going to be on the bottom line and not some ephemeral ethical obligation that they might start thinking they have.
But they have been able to get around regulation by hiring lobbyists and spending millions and millions of dollars, right?
In so many ways, I find that the processed food industry is far more powerful than the government agencies that are supposedly there regulating them on behalf of the consumers. You mentioned our tripling consumption of cheese over the years as a prime example of how the federal government, in fact, has been in cahoots with the industry to coerce us into eating more foods that are not healthy for us.
And how do they do that with cheese? How did that come about?
Cheese was an incredible story. So it goes back to the 1960s when people began drinking less whole milk in order to reduce their consumption of saturated fat, which is the fat that's linked to heart disease if consumed too much. That presented a problem to the dairy industry. They were suddenly, you know, getting a glut of whole milk and also a glut of milk fat, which is extracted from the whole milk to make skim milk or non-fat milk. Dairy industry began making more ice cream, more butter, and it made so much cheese that it began piling up the federal government wanting to subsidize the dairy industry as a national treasure or resource, began buying this cheese, but it began piling up. And around 1980, when Ronald Reagan came into office, his ag secretary put his foot down. The cheese was piling up. It was growing moldy. There were billions and billions of dollars that they were buying each year and just holding. He said, no more of this. But then the USDA turned around, Congress turned around, and created a system whereby the dairy industry can tax itself and raise tens of millions of dollars every year to promote the consumption of cheese. And this is cheese not just being promoted and marketed as something you would eat for itself on a sandwich or as an hors d'oeuvre before a meal, but cheese also as an additive. And so now when you go into the dairy aisle, it's bulging with bags of cheese that are shredded and diced and cubed and stringed and tubbed, all to encourage you to use it more in your own cooking at home as an additive because it's so alluring. But also, as you wander the grocery store, cheese became an ingredient in so many more foods. My favorite to look at is frozen pizza, where multiples of cheese were started to be put on top, but also put inside the dough. Again, the optimum word for the food industry with cheese is mouth feel. It provides incredible allure, but also lots of calories. And now cheese is the number one source of saturated fat in our diet.
Wow. We're talking with Michael Moss, author of the new book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. We've got about 10 minutes left. We have one open line. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. What questions do you have about the processed food industry, a trillion-dollar industry, and how has the addition of these three ingredients affected your eating habits, whether you know it or not? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from George in San Francisco. Hi, George. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Michael, if you were doing this research 20 years ago, you would be, you wouldn't be encountering any GMO products whatsoever. So in the past 20 years, one of the ingredients that so far I think you haven't mentioned, and maybe it's not within the scope of your research, is the addition of GMO products, which, unlike all the other things that we've been hearing you list, is not identified on the labels of products in the United States. And have you started to make any conclusions or draw any inferences from the introduction of GMOs in this food stream?
I've just actually begun looking at GMOs. Again, I shied away from other additives and other aspects of processed foods because people, you know, health experts were saying to me, look, the vast amounts of salt, sugar, fat that we're getting makes them sort of, you know, so much more important. But I hear you from you and other people in the GMOs. There is a lot of concern about them as to how they're affecting our health. There's a lot of pointing to Europe and their sort of pioneering on regulation on GMOs. And you also now start seeing in the store advertising by companies that are not using GMOs in their products. You can see that now on the front of the label. So to some extent, the industry is reacting to that concern.
All right. Well, thank you, George. We're definitely going to do another GMO show soon. I believe there's rallies, Monsanto rallies this Saturday, but I'll double check on that. Thank you, George. Let's go next to Marie Louise in Palo Alto. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning. And yes, I wanted to mention that I recently read an article that it supported a belief I have about low fat, no fat, and that was that children who are fed low fat milk when they are growing up, when they're small, they seem to have turn out to be more obese Now, I have no qualification, really, to speak of this, except that I read the article. But what I would really like to... So that's a question. But I also would like to say that I, when I eat very slowly. But the major thing, I think, is I keep the food in my mouth and taste it, and then chew it, and then swallow it. And I have lately started to say, kiss your food, swallow it.
Well,
and I think if I were the man whose children just don't really want to try to eat the things that might be better for them, one of the things they could do as a family is they could sit around the table and say, let's see who can keep the food in your mouth for a while by chewing it, tasting it, and all of that.
Well, it's great for the digestive system, that's for sure. Thank you for the call. What are your thoughts on that, Michael?
Yeah, you know, my mom used to say to us, chew your food 20 times before you swallow it. And she wasn't just getting us to avoid choking on the roast beef. I think that she instinctually knew that it takes time for your stomach to catch up with your taste buds. And this, you know, generally I'm finding that the smartest people I'm talking to are saying, look, you know, one of the big problems here is that we moved into an era of sort of mindless eating of food, the hand to mouth, the snacking, and that anything that that can get you toward being more mindful about eating food is going to be hugely helpful. And again, I know that Michael Pollan points out in his book that actually cooking food yourself will slow you down and you'll eat less of it when you're done, which is totally fascinating.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Let's go next to John in San Francisco. Hi, John.
Hi. Actually, I just had a question about what Michael thinks the role of restaurants is within this industry and, you know, what, if anything, can really be done by chefs and restaurateurs to kind of change in this movement.
Well, what kind of restaurants are you talking about? Because the chains, for sure, Salt, Sugar, Fat, that they do that well. But if you're talking about, you know, sort of healthier upscale restaurants in San Francisco, it's a little different.
Yeah, I know. I guess, and that's the crux, I guess, of what I'm trying to get at with the question is, right, I mean, technically, a lot of these organizations are treated the same by our government, whether you're Chez Panisse or you know, McDonald's.
Right.
And so I'm curious about, you know, what the future in that, if there's any possibility for real change.
Yeah, I mean, especially with fast food, because let's face it, if you don't have money, you by default, this is the stuff you're eating, right? Michael?
Yeah, I was really... So I sort of think of that on two levels. One, it kind of depends to what extent you're relying on restaurants for your overall diet. I mean, when I go out to an upper-end restaurant, it's an occasional thing, and I pig out without any regret because I know I'll go back to my normal diet the next day. But if you're relying on lower-priced restaurants for a huge part of your diet, then, yeah, you've got to think about what's in every one of those meals, just like you would if what you're buying in the grocery store. What I was totally intrigued by, though, was how fast food has migrated into the grocery store. And I write about the development of the kids' lunch called the Lunchables, which really became just a huge sort of marketing device on the half of the company making them, but also it sort of marshaled this era of fast food type meals coming, prefixed meals coming into the grocery store, where inherently I think we still have a basic trust. And this is one issue facing the food companies that I think they're going to be wrestling with here. We still think walking into the grocery store that, look, while there's soda and while there's chips and candies and things to distract us, we still think that basically we're going in there for foods that are making us healthy and stronger. And the emergence of fast food type foods in the grocery store when our guard is let down, I think, is something that is of significant concern to health officials.
We're almost out of time, but can you also just quickly talk about the other interesting fact that you uncovered? And this is fascinating that these industries actually specifically target their products to poor Latinos and Blacks.
Yeah, I mean, going back decades and doing sort of the basic research, they have learned that, you know, different groups have different you know, levels of liking for especially sugar and salt. And so you now start seeing some marketing of products, especially to the hugely growing Hispanic market, that are high in salt and also sort of chips that even have some sugar added to them too. And that's, you know, that's a targeting that goes on sort of demographically, but you also do see some variability in the formulations in those products.
And I have to put you on the spot because we've got just 30 seconds left, but a number of listeners wrote in about processed foods, about lobbying, about subsidies. How do we address these issues? Because they're all so connected.
The level, the playing field in the grocery store is so incredibly unlevel. It does sort of start with subsidies. I mean, so much of the ultra-processed foods are getting help from the government, especially in research and development, that the fruits and the vegetables don't. But even on the level of just marketing and advertising, these companies put so much money into promoting and selling and getting us to buy processed foods, and almost none of that goes into the dairy, into the fresh produce fruit aisle, which again makes shopping so difficult for people, besides which they tend to cost more than processed foods.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining us. The book is fascinating. We didn't even get to talk about Finland, but we'll have to have you back and talk about what Finland is doing to tackle this issue. Michael Moss, author of Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Thank you, Michael.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thank you. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for listening.
And you are listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco. I'm Matt Martin, joining Rose Aguilar here in the studio. And we have 3 minutes in our No Interruption, Shorter is Better spring membership campaign to ask for your support. And Rose, I have to tell you, a lot of people want to get a hold of a copy of this book, Salt, Sugar, Fat. People have been calling at 800-525-9917, 800-525-9917. We have this book, a number one New York Times bestseller. Really remarkable how much it brings together. And Rose, I know you're saying, hey, there's just so much to talk about here, Michael. So many stories to tell. Your support at 800-525-9917. $120 or more, we will send you this book as our thanks.
And we have a 20-call challenge for $1,000. We have 11 calls and clicks so far. We've got 9 to go. Thank you so much. John Calloway in San Francisco, Keith Yamamoto in San Francisco, and Kelly
Horner,
thank you, in Mill Valley at 800-525-9917, 800-525-9917, or kalw.org. I threw a tease out there about Finland. Just quickly, they took on the sugar industry and said, if you don't label it, we're going to label it high salt. Well, guess what? They had an 80% decline in the number of deaths from strokes and heart disease. That is the kind of fascinating information you'll find in Michael Moss's book. At 800-525-9917, a $120 pledge, and we'll send you his fascinating book. You can also go online to kalw.org.
And at any level of gift, whether you give $25, $50, $120, get the book Salt, Sugar, Fat. We've had gifts of $500 and $1,000 today. At any level, you will help us toward this challenge and help keep KALW and Your Call strong.
Thank you so much. 800-525-9917. Shorter is better. We are on the Shorter is Better campaign, and we're doing so well. Thank you for your support. 800-525-9917. I was just telling Matt that next pledge drive, I think I'm going to offer a cooking class for pledge, because we're getting so much response to these shows about food, and it's so incredibly important. You can also go online to kalw.org.
800-525-9917. 45 seconds before we go to World Have You Safe from the BBC. We're not interrupting the programming. You had an hour with Michael Moss. Your support at 800-525-9917. Or it's just as good. A click is as good as a call at kalw.org. Will help us make this better way of fundraising and keeping this station strong. 800-525-9917.
800-525-9917. We have a few phone calls to go to meet this challenge.
Let's
we know
it.
We can do it. KALW.org. Support these kinds of conversations. 800-525-9917 or KALW.org. Shorter is better. Supporting local independent radio. 800-525-9917. KALW.org.